Jetzt wechseln wir wieder in die englische Sprache. So I'm going to switch to English. And the next talk is going to be by Stephanie Pozavec. And it's, I don't know if you know the book. It's called Dear Data. It's been around since some time, but it's really remarkable. I have it at home as well. I haven't finished it because it's like every page is so dense. You have to really look into the stuff that's in there. It's a book about a conversation between two people based on data. And what I admire most about the book is actually the perseverance in it. Because I can start a dialogue with data, but I can't keep it on for so many postcards that you sent each other. So give it up for Stephanie Pozavec.
Yay. Okay, I am on. Great. So firstly, thank you for listening to me speak in English, because my German, I can only say please and thank you, so it would be a really boring talk. Also, I just want to say my slides are stretched, so if you just imagine that all the slides are a bit squished, I would greatly appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you for having me here. I am obviously Stephanie, and I am a designer whose favorite material is data. It doesn't really fit into the rubber band categories. I didn't really find a category when I got these. And I create data-driven designs for both art commissions and commercial work, ranging from information design to creating physical objects and public installations from data. And I will often create work that uses data as a starting point in order to communicate messages that go beyond the insights locked within the data itself. And these messages are often more subjective and often more emotional. And this different way of working with data can be seen in this piece at the Olympic Park. It was up last summer in East London, and it was made using a slightly chaotic data that school children had collected from the park. And it was visualizing this data not for statistical insight, but instead to inform the design of this new data-driven park landscape. And another example can be seen in a collection of 1,000 small drawings on index cards that visualize data from 1,000 frequently used English words, where this was visualized not to draw statistical insight, but instead to highlight the beautiful variation in the English language and displayed at a British Council pavilion at a book fair in Mexico. And also, while working with data, for many projects in my past, I've ended up shaping and molding it through analyzing it by hand. And of course, I do work with developers, but I don't code myself for like only this much. And so I often focus on this very manual engagement with data. And so really, you can see that instead of communicating with traditional design materials, I choose to communicate with data, often data gathered in a manual, laborious, and analog way. And for me, working with data as a designer was a natural fit, and I'm often surprised that more designers don't work in this day, as it makes sense that in this day and age where we create data almost just by breathing, that this would be a plentiful material for designers to work with and also to critique. And as for data visualization, I see it as a design process that I use to work with this material, a process that as we move into the future will be as common a method for a designer to create and communicate with as much as the golden mean, color theory, design systems, and all of the other rules of thumb and tools that designers use daily. And seeing data visualization as a vital part of communication design has challenged me to extend the visual languages that designers use to work with data, exploring ways of presenting data that, besides being legible, are more memorable and more expressive to a layperson audience who might just be learning about data for the first time. So, in short, I see the layperson, uninitiated into data, as my main design client, and so I'm trying to find ways to make them care about data. And so instead of only approaching data projects with visual responses like this, which many of you, I'm sure, are used to, that could mean making data danceable, like those are supposed to be moving people dancing. Like this project as the first data artist in residence at Facebook, where I converted a month of a couple's interactions on Facebooks into dance steps, bringing their digital dance across Facebook timelines into a physical space. Or it could mean making data hoppable, such as my open data playground for the South Bank Center in London, where, well, there's supposed to be a little kid doing a hopscotch across that, where hopscotch games were created from open data sets in order to communicate how open data sets are online for anyone to interpret and play with however they choose, even, okay, this is, was supposed to be a joke, even if some interpretations are more unconventional than others. Those are little kids running across and not paying attention to the hopscotch. Anyway, sorry, my animations aren't working. Or it could mean a project that's touchable and wearable, like this art commission I created with Miriam Quick, where we explored physical ways of communicating open air quality data from Sheffield in 2014 in a memorable experiential way for a citizen audience who might not be interested in air quality or data in general. So one part of the project presented weeks of particulate matter as data as something that you could touch and wear, and the other part communicated a day of pollution levels in Sheffield at, through glasses that would make your vision more or less hazy depending on the data. But even, oh, wrong one. Okay. Even when rendered in this playful way, talking about data and getting people to care about it is still a challenge. And many lay people see data as boring and inaccessible, or at least that's, I'm basing this anecdotally on how many people switch off at parties when I say that I work with data. And also, when I was creating this open data playground for the South Bank Center that I showed you, which is created from open data, and I asked someone nearby the installation if they knew what open data was, and then they asked me, well, what's data? And it gave me pause for thought. And, you know, data can feel like an indecipherable topic to many lay people, even to me. I mean, I'll confess right now and say that I definitely don't adhere to all the data privacy advice and data checks that I should. I'm always getting the feeling that I'm really only seeing the tip of the iceberg. And so the idea of data can feel overwhelming, even to someone who's made their career from it. But I believe that this is because to most lay people, data feels like something that's far removed from their daily lives, that's bigger than they're able to comprehend, cold, clinical, computerized, hidden away in the in big blue servers, like in this photo of a Google data center. And if we want people to begin to care and be interested in something that's not going away and will be part of their lives for the foreseeable future, then we need to come up with a different approach. And I think I've been getting closer to understanding how to make data, to make this material more accessible after embarking on the next project that I'll show you, a recent collaboration with Georgia Lupi, the creative director of the information design agency Acurat, based in Milan in New York. Now, Georgia and I only met twice in person when in 2014 we decided to collaborate. And we wanted to collaborate because we discovered we have many personal and work similarities. The personal ones being, maybe you can tell from my accent, we're both proud immigrants. Georgia's a proud Italian immigrant living in New York, and I'm an American immigrant living in London. We're also both the same age to be hidden, and we're also both only children. So we have a lot in common personally, but most importantly, we both don't really code, but we prefer to work with data in this very handcrafted analog way that I described earlier, which is often in contrast to the often standard use of computing and algorithms as part of the data visualization process. And so we decided to challenge ourselves. Since data visualization was the language that we spoke for work, we would use this language to get to know each other better, ideally in this very analog, hand-drawn way. And So over a summer of emails back and forth, we decided to use our biggest constraint, that we lived on different continents, as our biggest asset. And so we came up with a project that we called Dear Data, a year of sending hand-drawn data postcards back and forth across the Atlantic. So starting on the 1st of September 2014 and lasting a year, every week we collected our personal data around a shared topic to investigate aspects of ourselves and our days we then share with the other person. And then at the end of the week, we would spend time analyzing our data, and then we would painstakingly draw our visualizations and their annotations on a postcard. And then once we were finished, we would drop the postcard in a mailbox or a postbox and wait with our fingers crossed. And if all went well, the postcard would arrive at the other person's address. And then we would, you know, grab the postcard, grab a coffee, and sit down with the postcard and read and learn more about the other person's life. Now, all of our postcards follow the same structure. The fronts of the postcards contain no text or explanation. It was just the drawn data. And then the back of the postcard had a stamp and address, of course, but also a very detailed legend explaining how to read our drawings. Through this format, every week was an exploration of small data made very human and personal due to its inherent imperfections, where even our choices in data collection and what we chose to include and not to include function as a unique representation of each person. And so over the year, the whole project became a fragmented self-portrait sent to the other. So now, just to show very briefly how the project unfolded, I'll just show you a few of the postcards in more detail. And when we started the project, we started the year gathering data on how often we checked a clock to figure out what time it was that week, so quite a weird data set. And then on the second week, we tracked our walks and the type of transportation we used through our respective cities. And here we turned the Moves movement tracking app on to gather this data. And this was actually the first and last time where we used an external app to automatically track us. As we both agreed, it felt like we weren't really in control, and it felt impersonal to be tracked by an app as opposed to personally tracking our own data. And so, as the weeks progressed, we mainly explored themes requiring manual data collection, focusing on what computers can't gather, or at least they can't gather yet, and trying to move beyond the usual quantified self data into something more akin to personal documentary, where the main pursuit was to use this data capture to make sense of our world for ourselves, to connect and be present in our days and week, and also to create a souvenir of our lives to send to the other person. And so as we went through the year, we gathered data on a variety of topics, including more lighthearted topics like how much we drank over a week, or our swearing, like how many rude words we said were shown on screen, or we would experiment with trying to capture like very fleeting emotions, things that are very difficult to capture, like a week of every time we laughed, which was kind of like a challenging, almost impossible pursuit. And then we would also explore gathering data that forced us to confront our bad habits, like a week of every time we felt envy or a week of negative thoughts. And then we also extended the project beyond real-time data gathering, moving to weeks where we surveyed parts of our lives for the other, like surveying our collections of books, which are on screen, or our music collections, or our wardrobes, and so on. And then, since gathering data on your behavior inherently changes your behavior, we were sort of poking fun at this, and so we would try what we called performative data tracking, where we tried to gather particular data sets in the hope that the data gathering would make us change our behavior in a positive way. So, like trying something new, which is shown on screen, or smiling at strangers, or being kinder to those around us. And then at the end of the year, after 52 weeks, it seemed fitting to end the project with a week of goodbyes. And so at the end of the year, we had this this collection of 104 unique hand-drawn data visualizations. And, I mean, you've already heard my plug about the book, but if you do want to see them in more detail, Penguin You can get the Penguin copy through Europe. So, yeah. So that was the project, a quick run through. And now I'll just talk about some of the professional insights that we learned while working on the project and as we move through the year, drawing and sending postcards to each other. Firstly, this year made us believe in the benefits of human-scale data. In Dear Data, we found that this small, very human scale we've been working on opened the idea of data to a wider audience and made it more approachable. Because as I mentioned before, Georgia and I have both found that it's often difficult to get people to understand what big data or open data is. And they don't know what data is in the first place. And so now we see that we need to explore projects to answer this question first. And since Dear Data looked at domestic and often mundane data that most people can relate to, we've been able to show that data is something that is quite simply in every aspect of our lives, and it isn't necessarily scary, and it isn't always intimidating. And in short, we think that this small human-scale data is a friendly stepping stone to more in-depth, bigger-picture conversations about data's place in our culture and society, data privacy, and so on. And so starting small is how we hope to increase data literacy and further these conversations. And also, by gathering, analyzing, and drawing our small data in this very manual way, we're highlighting how when learning basic principles of working with and visualizing data, you don't need fancy programs or incredible data analysis skills to begin with. All you really need is a pencil to start. So we really like this accessible side of it as well. Now, halfway through the year, we made the project public, and we saw people describe Dear Data in new ways, using words where data begins to feel human and where data is being described as something warm instead of something cold, and changing the perception of what is possible with data, and so moving beyond only thinking data is boring or inaccessible. And this positive feedback that we've received about Dear Data, I think is really testament to the fact that this manual domestic way of introducing people to data resonates with them. And because we've also received quite a few emails from people who are starting Dear Data correspondence projects of their own. Some are even working through an entire year, or they're using it as part of their teaching materials for all ages, from primary school, middle school, high school, university, and beyond, to help students learn to collect and present data. And so, really, this is what we're most excited about. We're both excited about how something that was effectively a side project between two designers, a portfolio piece, ended up becoming a community project. And as we move into the future, this is something that we're looking to expand upon. Now, okay, so that's the usual sort of Dear Data insights thing that I always say, or that we always talk about. And Dear Data and the resulting book, for me personally, because I'm freelance, have been my biggest projects for the past 2 years. And now that the dust has settled a bit, I'm asking myself, well, why was it so successful? What aspect of the human experience were we tapping into that made people excited about this data? Now, as like you've probably heard, and as I've mentioned before, I'm American. I've spent the past 14 years in the UK. I've been a British citizen for nearly 5, and so I've been beginning to better understand the nuance and idiosyncrasies of UK English and British culture. And so while I've been here, at some point I stumbled upon a British slang term that piqued my interest. The slang term anorak, now one of my favorite words, and after research online, I can define an anorak as, I don't have an animation, but I'll describe it for you as best I can. An anorak is someone who's interested in the collection of minuscule, arcane, and quite often useless bits of information. So this is supposed to be an animation of a really nerdy guy in a green parka standing on a train platform and like counting all of the train, recording all the train numbers that pass by. Because that's where the term anorak comes from, the coat that train spotters wear as they collect their data. So after looking at an anorak's usual output, which is over on the left. So lots of handmade notations, jottings, and tallies, like in these notebooks from a train spotter and a bird spotter. And then looking at the output of my design process, and then looking at the 104 different esoteric data sets that we collected as part of our Dear Data project. Well, it's pretty clear that Georgia and I are officially card-carrying anoraks as well. That's the slang term. It should apply to us, too. Now, as you can see in this film, which isn't running, the term anorak, this is a really, really nerdy guy, because the term anorak is seen as being derogatory and negative in the UK, because it's seen to be nerdy, uncool, and antisocial to be collecting data on things you're passionate about. But I'm surprised this word's so derogatory when it actually applies to everyone in this room or in the world, because I really think that we are all secret anoraks. We all act like data magpies, collecting seemingly useless numbers and storing them away as we move about our day. Now, I mean, many of us in this room will know our precise weight, watching every tiny creep of the numbers up and down the scale, or we might mark places we visited on a wall map at home, or know the calorie count of all of our favorite biscuits. And I think many of these numbers, these tiny data sets that I've mentioned, could also be considered as meaningless and as useless as the data that an anorak collects. But of course, we would never chastise a new parent for their collection of the often useless data traditionally gathered in a baby book, or we would never talk badly of a family that carefully collects the heights of its family members in a special place in their house. These tiny data sets, these numbers are cherished and they're held onto through the years. So as you can see, many people gather this small data or carry these numbers around to get closer to the things that matter to them. But it isn't useless as the basic act of collecting this tiny data on a topic, any topic, means it's important to the author and brings the author closer to subjects they care about. So looking at the data that you gather as a secret anorak is a way of figuring out what's really important to you. And so this is something that we all do and is an experience that I believe we all partake in. And there can be meaning, satisfaction, and enjoyment in this experience, even if it doesn't have an explicit purpose or explicit statistical insight. And experience is really the right word, because data gathering has been part of our human experience for tens of thousands of years. As early human writing systems weren't first used to record poetry, mythology, and history, but were used from the beginning to record data, to record accounts. And when we look at data from this viewpoint, we can see a view of data that's quite different to the often cold and computerized perception of big data, where data can be seen as warm and part of the human story, and data gathering is an act that can often be joyful, emotional, memorable, and meaningful. And I'm skipping it because it's a duplicate. Now, this more imperfect, emotional, anorak-style small data approach often ruffles the feathers of many scientists and data visualization practitioners, because statistical insight isn't the reason for gathering and visualizing this data. But I believe more than ever that we don't just have to collect and visualize data for statistical insight, because now a data set can be presented with a focus on its lateral truths that reveal a collector or visualizer's emotions, wants, needs, personality, and so on. And artists can respond to a data set in the same way they can respond to an event, an era, or something in the culture around them. And anoraks can gather data for the experience and enjoyment of using this process to get closer to something they love. And so for me, I'm really excited about how the same data set can now be a scientific and analytical material and a cultural artifact and the souvenir of an experience, eliciting completely different responses in these different spaces, and all of these responses are valid and valuable. And also, all of these responses offer a different access point for people who are just learning, first like learning about and beginning to understand data. But really, there's a similarity between these different camps, with data scientists on one side and the anoraks and artists or designers on the other. While they both might work with data in different ways, they're both looking for truth and understanding either of their subject or themselves, except for they're using that truth to different ends. And again, these anorak-style, not very statistical projects that might be imperfect artifacts from an imperfect human experience may feel more approachable and could be a more successful way to get some people interested in understanding data in the first place. In Georgia, and I believe this warmer direction we're championing is finding success in the design community. And, you know, we've had incredible validation of this approach, as our original postcards and the sketchbooks where we planned them out were acquired by the Museum of Modern Art in New York at the end of last year. And this acquisition convinced us of the value of an analog design approach, and I believe the project's success is really due to how it speaks to the latent anorak tendencies that we all have. So finally, through Dear Data, being an anorak has moved from something negative to something positive. And as Paola Antonelli, MoMA's senior design curator, states when describing the project, she said, "This engaged conversation describes the future of our relationship with information." And engaged conversation is the right phrase, as when we received each other's postcards, Georgia and I would text and ask questions that started from the drawn conversations found in our data. And it's been a reminder to us that our personal data was always a starting point and the beginning of a deeper conversation about our lives. And I believe we, from designers to artists to developers to data visualization specialists, all need to remember that our perception of data isn't fixed and steadfast, but is a conversation that started thousands of years ago. And that by creating projects that tap into this inner anorak that we all secretly harbor within ourselves, we can use these small personal experiences with data and numbers as a reference point as we shape the future of data in our society. Thank you.